Now we're in South Canterbury with Cosmo Kentish Barnes. He's with Amanda Simon from the Ngaitahu Māori Rock Art Trust and Rachel Solomon, who manages the Tiana Māori Rock Art Centre in Timaru. The trio are heading inland from Pleasant Point.
We're near the Opahi River, which is a significant cultural feature on the landscape. If you think back to the early days, mana whenua were using the rivers as the main highways to move around and gather resources, mahinga kai, as different resources came into season. So we're adjacent to a major highway from those days.
From where we are standing, there is farmland as far as the eye can see, really.
Yep, that's right. We're on a property that has been a farming property for many years, and in fact some of Rachel's relations own the farm. So that's a weird connection there. And this farm is, well, I guess it's not unique in that it contains hidden treasures. There's taonga on this property in the form of many Māori rock art sites, and that's not atypical for properties in South Canterbury because of the beautiful limestone geology, which lends itself as a beautiful pale creamy canvas for Māori rock art.
When did you first come to this site?
I first came to this property, it probably would have been in the early 2000s, and at that stage it was a small operating farm and it had a lessee on it, and the property was reasonably well known for one of the beautiful Māori rock art drawings here, the iconic Opahi Taniwha frieze, and it's just an incredible Māori rock art site. But I think first impressions, you come onto the property and it doesn't look anything much. It just looks like an operating farm, and you wander down a small gully and then you find yourself in quite a different landscape.
Does the Rock Art Trust lease this land?
We lease a 13 hectare area, and that 13 hectares is pretty marginal in terms of farming values. And the remainder of the farm is leased to another farmer, which is good. And we've had a really good relationship with the landowner here. He is very supportive of the work that we do here to protect the rock art sites. And I think there's some commonalities in that his family have been on this property for several generations, and he feels a sense of connection and guardianship towards the property. And with that lease arrangement, the landowner allowed us, rather than paying our lease fee, which is $5,000 a year, for the first 8 years to just use that money to do what we needed to do in terms of infrastructure here to protect the sites. And to be honest, that 8-year period expired a while back and the arrangement continues. So, you know, like, this is a significant financial contribution from a private landowner who didn't have to do that. So it's, you know, we're looking in the range of $50,000 really in terms of that person's personal waiving of the fee and us being able to put that money back into developing the property and planting and all things like that.
So far, 23,000 native plants have been planted in and around the gully, and this will double over the next several years.
The idea is to bring back some of those natural values that would have been present at the time that the rock art was created. So we've commissioned a 10-year ecological restoration and management plan for the property, and we're about 4 years into that. And yeah, we're starting to see the benefits of that now. The plants are really well established down in the gully, and insect life is thriving, and that's bringing birds back. We're seeing tuna eel in the creek. So yeah, it's just so pleasing to see, you know, all of that coming back to life.
The Trust has also partnered with Manaaki Whanua to work on a research project focused on the paleoecology of the site.
We're looking at the ecology over deep time, so taking sediment cores to understand what the ecology of this site would have been pre-human arrival in Aotearoa, and then, you know, what were the changes when Māori came, and then what were the changes again on European settlement and farming. So we'll have a really fine-grained understanding of exactly what was here from that research. And, we can bring all of this information to life for tamariki in the local district and beyond.
And what's your background? Do you have a close connection with this land here?
Only in so much as I've spent a lot of my working life focused on it. But this is one of like 760 rock art sites in Te Waipounamu in the South Island. So it is a very important one to me because I've had a close kind of relationship with this property over my working life, and it's really important to me the relationships that we've formed with the landowner here and the work that we're able to do here.
Now the planting starts right at the top here and sort of leads us down into the gully.
Yeah, it's really nice. So you can see quite a well-established area of planting that we did way back in 2015. Yes. You can see te koka. What else can we see? There's a bit of harakeke Kortia in some places.
Where do you source all the plants from?
So at the moment we have an excellent relationship with Matai Nurseries down in Waimati. So the idea is to eco-source the plants. So we want plant stock that is from the local area.
Rachel, Amanda said that you are connected to the farmers here. Tell me about that.
Through a marriage that's no longer, but my children are from the whānau that own the property. Here.
Do your children come down here and help with the planting?
No, they don't live in Timaru anymore, but my son had a wee bit to do with the trust and helping with excavation, and he studied archaeology and IT. My daughter is in Massey studying a Bachelor of Design, but she, funny enough, she has been down here. And as any teenager at the time, just went, you know. but then through her studies, she's learnt, they've been studying a bit about Māori rock art, and lo and behold, the Upahi Taniwha. So that was kind of a nice connector for her.
Oh, now as we head down the gully, the wind drops off, which is quite nice because it's quite a chilly breeze, isn't it, Amanda?
Yeah, bracing South Canterbury spring day. And you're starting to see the beautiful limestone formations, which are like works of art in their own right, I reckon. You know, the beautiful shape and form of them, but also all of the natural coloration and the mosses and lichens on them. So, yeah, stunning landscape.
Did livestock used to graze down here?
Yeah, yep. So there have been sheep grazing down in the gully. So like from a conservation perspective, in terms of protecting the Māori rock art, excluding stock from the area is an important thing.
Halfway down the steep gully is a cave, shaded by a large overhanging rock. Under it, old farm machinery gathers dust.
Some drays and also a reaper binder, probably from the 1870s. So, yeah, this is a bit of an in-joke for rock art people out there, but we call this Cave of the Forgotten Farm Implements, and that's a reference to the film Cave of Forgotten Dreams that is about rock art. so, anyway, yes, it's part of the social history of the property, so I kind of like to think as you walk down into the gully, you're walking back through time. You know, we arrived in our vehicles and we're walking down and now we're seeing, you know, farm equipment from the 1870s, and we'll go deeper in time as we go down.
Now, the gully really does open up after this cave, and the limestone rocks have turned into cliffs.
Yeah, we're starting to see a bit more scale in the limestone, so It's a good place to shelter.
Yes, and the native plantings here are 2, 3, nearly 4 metres high.
Yes, and interesting, like our ecologist is quite surprised at the strike rate down here with our plants and the growth rate, and I keep saying to him, oh no, it's Tunny Farm magic. That's what's happening down here.
Hello. Hello, how you doing? There's a dog.
That's Barb, one of our restoration workers.
Hi, Barb.
No, it's country life. It's good to have a dog in the program.
A bit of barking would be great. So, Barbara, you are doing some weeding here today?
Yeah, and some of these plants have only been in about 6 months, and so they're quite vulnerable at this time of year to getting overtaken by the really lush weeds. So cooch, nettle and hemlock, and they just overwhelm the plants.
And when you're not doing this, you are a local councillor.
That's right, yep.
What an amazing place to be.
It's not a bad office, is it?
We were lucky to get some funding through Jobs for Nature, Doc's Jobs for Nature Fund, which has allowed us to hire 3 restoration workers for 3 years, which has meant that we can make really quick progress on our 10-year plan, which might end up being a 7-year plan because of that. So, yes. Yeah, it's really cool.
Bellbirds? No.
Ho-ho?
Yeah, that's...
The overhang that we're standing in front of has a very special work of taonga.
Yeah, and we're just getting to a nice sunlight for viewing now. So when the sunlight bounces off the floor and illuminates the roof of the cave where the taniwha is, that's the best viewing light. So yeah, we're just about in range.
We're just coming through a small little gate.
The floor of the cave has got slabs of limestone that have fallen, you know, millennia ago. It's deeply overhung, so it's maybe 10 metres in. And, yeah, one of the reasons that we're in a cave that is fully caged from floor to ceiling is, you know, in the 1980s, a lot of caging of rock art sites was done, and that was to protect them from people that were damaging them.
Now, looking up, we can see a large drawing.
Yes, the drawing is quite large scale, so it would probably be about 1 metre wide and 4 or so metres long, and it features some intertwined sinuous figures, which we think of as taniwha. That's the kind of the whakaaro that goes with these these drawings. So one beautiful large taniwha figure, and the tail of that figure is intertwined with another taniwha figure, and then there's a third out to the side there. So they're mostly black, but there's a little bit of white there as well. So some of the surface of the limestone has been abraded, and that brings up a bright white that's been utilised in the design work too.
What sort of pigment was used to do the drawing with?
So there's so much about Māori rock art that we don't know. You know, a lot of the oral traditions surrounding this practice has just been lost over time. But one little gem of information that has been retained was collected by Harris Beattie, an ethnologist of the 1920s, and he bicycled around North Otago and South Canterbury collecting information from Komatua at the time. And one piece of information he collected was a recipe for rock art paint. And the recipe for rock art paint that he recorded was this: collect the branches of the manuao, which was a resinous native pine tree that could be burned while it was still green. Collect that, burn it, and then catch the rising smoke or soot on a tepaki or flax mat and then scrape that into a bowl. Other ingredients included the gum of the tarata tree, also included rotafiri berries that were put in a really fine woven keti and sat by the fire, and the pigment dripped out of those. That was added as well. And then either fat from weka or shark liver oil also added. So all of these ingredients have specific chemical properties and purposes to make a really beautiful paint. And also there's red paint, and in that case probably a similar recipe but utilising cork or white or iron oxide, which is, you know, naturally available in the landscape too. So thinking about this, this isn't idle doodling. It's not, as many people would think, using a burnt stick to, you know, just create a bit of art. It's well thought through, it's premeditated, there's a lot of traditional knowledge involved in the recipe for rock art paint, and it was known at that time as an ink that would stand forever, and lo and behold, it has. Here we are, we're still looking at the rock art, you know, centuries after it was created.
It would have been quite challenging to do it upside down. I guess it would have been a bit of a stretch to reach up.
Yeah, I think the floor of the cave has been a lot higher in the past, so potentially it's not so much reaching up, but maybe lying on your back and doing it, yeah.
It still would have been quite challenging, especially at the scale of it.
And how did they do it? Did the artist mark out the kind of perimeter of the design and then infill it, or were they freestyling it the whole way?
Yes.
It's pretty mind-boggling. And you can see, like, the natural features of the limestone are also incorporated in the design work too.
Rachel, what story do you think the artist was conveying?
There's one theory that this is the creation story with Papatuanuku being the Mother Earth. She's hapu, she's pregnant. You can see little hands coming out. She's connected to Raki, the Sky Father, which is the other bigger figure. And a bit further down there is Takiroa or Tangaroa, who she was once partnered with prior to Raki. And then the separation of Tane lying on his back and pushing his legs up and separating the mother and the father. That's one theory of this particular figure. There's also another theory where it's the three main rivers converging in this area, in the valley. Taniwha was sometimes associated with our rivers down here in Te Waipounamu. Yeah.
And sitting here under the overhanging rock is quite relaxing.
That's my happy place. I just enjoy that feeling of being in the footsteps of the ancestors in the place that that art was created. It's such a tangible connection to heritage, isn't it, you know? And, yeah, that's the thing that appeals to me.
What are the biggest threats to the preservation of beautiful rock art like this?
I think rock art, unlike other collections of national significance, of national heritage, it's out in the landscape. So it's a really tricky one from that perspective. I would say moisture is a real problem for rock art, and that's more because of the canvas, the limestone canvas that the rock art is applied to. So limestone's a soft rock and it's porous. And if there's changes in the hydrology around the shelters, that can potentially be really problematic, obviously, for the rock art that's on the surface of the limestone. So, yeah, in a region like South Canterbury, where much of the rock art is on operating farms, and when you think about the changes in farming practice over time, there's definitely been an intensification of dairy farming in our district, and that's of real, real concern, and that's because of the irrigation practices needed to support that intensive dairy farming. So we have partnered again with scientists to learn more about that and to understand, you know, the kind of buffer that you need around rock art sites to ensure that those changes in hydrology are not creating real problems for the rock art. But, I mean, you know, apart from the big problems of moisture and hydrology, wind, stock, sheep used to shelter in here, and you can see a kind of line of lanolin at sheep height in the back of the shelter. So stock in general will nibble and lick at the limestone because it's a marine deposit, so it's salty, which is a problem. Humans are a big problem. Graffiti, like the charitable part of me would say, graffiti is a marking of place, isn't it? So, you know, I guess there's a comparison that perhaps could be drawn with the rock art, but disrespectful graffiti on rock art sites really irks me. And being charitable again, perhaps people don't realise that they're desecrating a really important heritage site when they're doing that.
Rachel, do you bring people into the gully?
Yep, through to from around about October, November through to April.
25,000 kids have been through the centre and come down here to look at the rock art, and our aspiration there, as I said, is growing that next generation of rock art kaitiaki. So we want to learn as much as we can and then share that knowledge with as many people as we can.
Do you get groups of local farmers coming down?
Yeah, we have, and in the past the Rock Art Trust has run hui for landowners with rock art on their property, and those have been awesome events, and that those people that come along are sometimes, you know, we'd often hold them on marae, and sometimes that's the first time those people have been to a marae. So it's a powerful experience on a lot of levels for them. And I think it's really good for them also, that kind of sense of whanaungatanga, for them to get together with other landowners that have, you know, rock art on their property, and to meet, you know, members of our local runanga as well, and to share perspectives and get a really, like, a more holistic understanding of the treasures that they have in their own backyard. So I think it's really important just to share as much knowledge as you can. That's empowering people to make good decisions around the protection of rock art generally.
Amanda Simon ending that story from the Opihi Taniwha rock art site near Pleasant Point. Cosmo was also talking to Rachel Solomon and Barbara Gilchrist.